test pilot for all these helicopters. You know, these people have been sticking their neck out for years. So they, you know, they picked a real good group. I saw the whole interview. They interviewed them, and very, very well done. Mike Pence did a good job. Great job. Back to you.
Okay, so when it comes to recycling of water and recycling of oxygen, maybe 97%. But in order to truly be self-sustaining, you and I consume a significant amount of food. Our body extracts 130 watts of continuous energy out of that food by the metabolism. And what remains are waste products, solid waste, and that solid waste has to by some means be recycled. Now if you're recycling it by way of using it as fertilizer on a farm, that's one way of going, but that farm takes an acre of property per human being. I'm just rounding off numbers crazy. I presume it's the solid waste recycling that's the real tough one to conquer at this time. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, as far as I know. First of all, how's the copy on this? I can't repeat.
You're sounding good, Paul. Not to worry.
Go ahead, go down low power. Go through the machine. But sometimes it gives me grief, but right now it's good. Okay. Well, valves are tough. You've heard about the urine recycling and everything that gave. They have even the humidity floating around in the space station. It all gets recovered. If I'm not mistaken, I think it was 97 or probably 95% of oxygen gets recovered. So I guess solids and of course food, you know, that's going to be a problem. You have to bring up a year on the planet, 6 months there, 6 months back, minimum. You know, I'm guessing four people will eventually go. But I think the long-term plan is not to just go to Mars and land. Yeah, just like you have this space gateway, there's going to try to build around that.
When you first asked me, Paul, you were quite quiet. Now you are 30% noise, 70% signal. So the signal you're putting into that repeater right now is a little bit too weak. Go ahead. Either better aiming or more power is required.
Yeah, okay. We can do both. Stand by. Turn this thing around. Stand by. Oh, it takes about... I don't think it's about 30 seconds or so to reverse from the west to maybe a little longer than that. I'm up to the north now. Stand by. I'm going to switch it over.
Dick, in the meantime, you could check email. We've got help from Dr. Roy. So you have a picture, then you have the answer.
Yeah, I read Roy's email. And he's now figured out it is a quadrature hybrid. He found the exact model number and the exact data sheet.
Okay, I'm back, by the way. How's this thing?
Yeah, nice.
Beautiful. Hey, you're real good now, Paul. So, you aimed the antenna directly at the eastern repeater?
Yeah, copy that. Yes, I did. Okay, so we're good to go. I lost my train of thought. That's the way it goes. Let's see. Well, Wesley has some point to pick up with.
Yeah, we already picked up Wes, and Roy told us the exact, he found the exact data sheet on the quadrature hybrid that Wesley bought for $2 today. We're talking about solid food, solid waste recycling. I've often used as a very rough approximation that the amount of air, water, and food you and I consume in 1 year is approximately the volume of our house and approximately the mass of our house. Well, an awful lot of that is oxygen and water. If I only talk about the food, I don't know the exact number, but maybe 1/8 of the volume of your house, or 1/16 of the volume of your house, is the food you consume. That's an awful lot of volume in a year that's got to be recycled. That's a real tough one. And those habitat experiments, they didn't come very close, did they, Paul? And they took up an acre of property in trying to do it, or more, maybe more than an acre. WS2N, K2IW.
Yeah, it was quite a bit more than that. About 4 acres. It's a huge piece of property. But now, I got my train of thought back. One of the long-term goals, like Lockheed would like to see, after this deep space gateway is built, and they could use a lot of these Cygnus cargo vehicles built by Orbital ATK, and they could bolt those two together, similar to what they do on the space station, with docking ports and airlocks. They could do all of that around the moon. Lockheed has a long-time plan of sending modules, deep space habitat modules, after this moon deal to Mars. So when the first astronauts get launched and start heading to Mars, they won't be going down to the surface. They'll be going to another space station around Mars. So that's going to be these are all proposals. I think it could go that way. Next thing you know, you have somebody orbiting Mars and eventually leading up to EDL, entry, descent, and landing system. It has to be developed. And then takeoff system. You can't just leave people there. But I could see that happening. I've seen pictures, animation of what this would look like. Space station would be quite large. Again, 4 to 7 people on that space station. And that might be a way to go, a stepping stone, instead of just taking a chance, putting people down on the surface, hoping for the best, and trying to get them back in there.
Has anyone said roughly what year? Are we talking about, I guess, of maybe the year 2030, orbiting Mars? Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, in the late 2020s for orbiting Mars, somewhere in the 2030s for landing, and I'm sure that no matter which system they come up with or they decide on, probably late 2030s would be the earliest. Unless Elon Musk has something to say about it, he's going full blast now with all these launches. Successful one right after the other now. He's got another, I think at least 10 or 12 missions planned just for between now and the end of the year. Roughly every 2 to 3 weeks, he's got another launch. Between that, he's got big income coming in on that. He's got, probably over half of it is private money with all these private launch vehicles. Launch satellites that are going up. So he's got a lot of money coming in with that. Tesla Motors, he's selling Tesla cars left and right with electric cars. He owns Solar City. All the solar panels are being put up all around the country, maybe around the world. Tremendous income he's coming there, so I think eventually money won't be a problem with him or with Jeff Bezos. Jeff Bezos, he's interested in the moon, but Elon Musk is all about Mars, and I wouldn't be surprised if he tries to do something in the 2020s, probably late 2020s, maybe.
Each person that talks about Mars and a Mars landing make it sound like it's a goal at least as worthwhile as the Apollo mission going to the moon. And the main motivation for the Apollo mission going to the moon was to be in competition with the Soviet Union and a little bit of research of lunar material. How similar is it to Earth material? But when it comes to putting man on Mars, we talk about the fact that it's 1,000 times further away than the moon, probably 1,000 times more expensive, maybe close to 1,000 times more risk to human life. And with all of that cost, time, and expense, when you do put a human being on Mars, with great difficulty, to put them there, sustain them there, and get them back home, no one mentions what is the benefit to mankind of putting a human being on Mars. To put him there to form a colony and have them start farming, that's essentially out of the question as I see it. The movie The Martian makes it look easy. Let me drop it. It's nowhere near that easy. They cut a lot of corners when it comes to the degree of difficulty of doing what was going on in the Martian movie. So I haven't seen anyone say that when you put a man on Mars, this is the long list of benefits you get for doing that. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, that's philosophy. Elon Musk really believes, he's trying to tell me, he believes in one side. Now he's starting to get a little older already, but back in the early 2000s, he had plans on sending people to Mars and colonizing Mars. And he did find out how difficult it was as time went on. His first idea, he didn't have a rocket company or anything, but he wanted to pay for a Russian launch, have some kind of plant sent to Mars, some kind of a glass enclosure, and lands on a planet with a TV camera, and take pictures of this plant growing on Mars in some kind of little greenhouse. When he realized, of course, what was involved, the Russians, what everything was for, he decided at that point. So the story goes, I think this is on 60 Minutes, but that he decided to make it, develop his own rocket company, do it himself. So, he's had big ideas from the beginning, but whether or not he could overcome all the different problems that you bring up, growing food and water, probably not. And, he's more or less said so. He said, I'm supplying the vehicle. I'm basically supplying the ship. If he was in England and he was a shipbuilder, he'd be telling Queen Elizabeth, I'm building the ship. I'm sending it over. You want to bring over, plans for planting corn or whatever, that's up to you. So it's that type of deal with Elon Musk. So nobody's going to go unless there's some kind of infrastructure that's planned. K2RIWWS.
Mars has something like one-third the amount of sunlight of the Earth, essentially zero atmosphere. So to grow a plant on Mars, you have to supply the equivalent of a greenhouse that maintains atmospheric pressure as we know it. To do any substantial amount of growing, you'd like to have an acre's worth of property. Can you imagine making something that has a greenhouse-like effect, an area of an acre, and that whole acre has high-pressure window panes that can sustain 14.7 pounds per square inch? Tons per square foot on every square foot of 640 square feet of it's 40,000 square foot per acre. 40,000, so we're talking about 40,000 tons of pressure of the air on the panes of this greenhouse that allows you to grow an acre's worth of plants. Those numbers roll off the tongue real easy. To actually do that is extremely difficult. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
Yeah, he found that out and realized what he needed to do. Build his own space company, his own rocket company. So that's, to think that would have been an incentive to have pictures coming back of something growing. It would have been interesting, but, we have a tremendous amount of pictures coming back now from Mars. All the different vehicles that have landed there, the Viking missions, Pathfinder mission, spent sojourner driving around on Mars. Spirit and Opportunity, now Curiosity, and now another one going up in 2020 rover. European Space Agency has one that's supposed to go in 2018, that's going to go in 2020. China's got one, and so, wants to send something. You've got all these pieces of equipment driving around on Mars, showing the beautiful landscape. You have missions like the Phoenix mission. The Phoenix mission dug through the ground and found ice, and then one day the ice went away. And if that's not enough to start people's imagination, I think one little flower, I don't think, would have done it anyway. I think if he wants to go to Mars, he did the right thing. He has to build his own company, which he's doing. Now he's going to get ready to eventually launch the Falcon 9 Heavy. That's coming up in probably toward the end of the year, maybe sooner. And, the rockets are getting bigger. He's really getting, everything he says eventually starts to come true. A couple of years down the road, he predicts early, kind of like what NASA used to do. But I think he's on the right track. Might not do it, but if anybody can, I give him a shot. Probably as earliest would be 2029. I'm going to go with Elon Musk with the ITS, the Interplanetary Transportation System. He's got the whole design laid out, what kind of rockets he's going to use. He has a plan. Back to you,
Dave. A little bit like that movie, Make the Fields and They Will Come. So if he creates the transportation vehicle, he thinks people will go there. As you can tell, I'm having trouble with that one, Paul, because what's the purpose of sending them there? What are you going to get in return? Huge cost, huge risk, and other than bragging rights, what can you do there that an unmanned vehicle can't do? When it comes to the 2020 lander on Mars, it's got to have a RTG, radioactive thermal generator. Has the plutonium for that RTG been designated? And how many kilograms of plutonium is in the Curiosity RTG? Over you, Paul, KQRIW.
I know it's 103 watts output. And how many kilograms? I'm going to go with, I think it's about, I thought they said it was around 9 pounds, but that might be with the graphite blanket that surrounds it. But it's relatively small. You can see it's sticking off on about a 45-degree angle out of the back of Curiosity. So that's pretty amazing. One thing I wanted to say about when we might go there, more or less a question, was similar to that was asked to Jack Fisher, the astronaut on the International Space Station, still up there, K2FSH. He was asked by one of the students a question that has something to do with time frame. Like, would you like to go to the go to Mars? Let me drop it. And his answer was, he's laying out everything that will be done on the International Space Station. It's basically practice for deep space missions such as Mars. So he's thinking probably one of you, and he's a great student, would be probably one of the ones that would first make it to Mars. So that gives you an idea of the time frame of what he's thinking. By the way, those answers could be found, all the questions and answers could be found on St. Joseph's School's website. If you go to that website, bring up St. Joseph's School, Ron Cockman. Great school. And They have a website. You click on it. They have all the questions and answers. You can't, sometimes you can't understand the YouTube version if you listen to YouTube. It was very clear when I was there. And it's pretty clear on YouTube, but not as clear as what I heard when I was there in person. So it's just unbelievable. Back to you, Dick, WSY.
Of the people listening to me right now, do any of you guys have any further questions for Paul during the space report? Give me your call. There's a name right now. KQRIW listening.
AT2LR with a question and info.
Okay. I heard LR, and I heard another person on the input who doesn't have the right PL. He's not coming through the machine. So LR first, go right ahead.
LR. My question was, my name is Kay. My question was, what app or what did Rich, I think it's KTUPS, Rich, if you're listening, what did you sign up for to get a an alert on your cell phone in order to find out about the Wallop launch? And my question, my info is that I'm reading on the Medford patch that the rocket launch was postponed until tomorrow night because it was too windy tonight. So they're going to do it same time, 9:04 to 9:19 p.m. tomorrow.
Okay, thank you for the information, Kay. Let's see if Rich is still with us, if he's not taking his rest period. He's got two drivers on that vehicle, and they flip back and forth. K2 Uncle Papa Sierra. Are you there, Rich? K2LIW. Uncle Papa Sierra / mobile. I was a little bit afraid of that. He might be during his sleep period at this time, Kay. Kay, do you have any other questions for Paul while you're here? AC2LR, K2LIW in the TechNet.
No, thank you, but I thoroughly enjoy the space reports and the whole TechNet, of course. Back to you, Dick, AC2LR.
Kay, if we keep paying you, will you keep saying that? That's intended to be humor, but I know it's left-handed. There was a person I heard on the input who didn't have the right PL turned on, so he wasn't coming through the machine. Maybe he has corrected that. And if not, just make another transmission. I'll read you on the input. The other person who signed in, K2LIW listening. Go right ahead.
I can't believe my Motorola radio doesn't put out PL. It puts that out every time I squeeze the microphone. Don't know what happened.
Okay, you're coming through bright, beautiful now, Joe. Go right ahead.
W2LRY. Well, this question is directed probably more towards you, but it could be, you know, part of this, you know, talk on space. You have talked and said that looking at the sky, I guess temperature-wise, is something like 2.7 Kelvin, which I guess is a few degrees above absolute zero. If that's what space is, on an average, how did they come up with, you know, getting something down to absolute zero on Earth, and exactly how did they do that? Back to you.
Okay. Temperature, at first, to all of us, is a mysterious property. You measure it with something you call a thermometer, and there's a zillion kinds of electronic, mechanical, and fluid, and whatever, thermometers. What does a thermometer do? It measures average kinetic energy of the molecules. The air in the room with you right now, Joe, is moving at 500 meters per second. Each individual air molecule has an average speed of 500 meters per second. 1.5 times the speed of sound is the average speed of each one of those air molecules. Those air molecules are roughly 3 nanometers apart from each other. And if you take any one air molecule, you calculate the diameter of an oxygen or a nitrogen molecule, and you figure out the spacing, each one moves on average something like 28 or 30 nanometers before it strikes another one. So here's an air molecule. You decide to watch air molecule number 9. You watch him scoot at 500 meters per second to the north. He moves 30 nanometers and he strikes another air molecule and then bounces in some other direction. So it's a real random walk. And therefore, you can't say he's got a velocity of 500 meters per second, because velocity is direction plus magnitude. So there ain't no direction to this. It's got an average speed, but direction is bouncing all over the place. Now, with a whole bunch of experiments, let me drop it. With a whole bunch of experiments, you see the relationship between the temperature that you measure in Fahrenheit, centigrade, or Kelvin, and you see the speed at which the molecules of your substance being measured, the speed at which they're moving. And you draw a graph, and you realize that at four times the, at twice the temperature, you've got four, let me think now. At twice the temperature, you've got twice the amount of kinetic energy, which means you've got 70% more speed. So you can project that backwards. You get a linear graph. You get a straight line graph of temperature versus kinetic energy. And then you ask yourself the question, okay, if I keep going to the left on the graph, where does the kinetic energy go to zero? And that's at a temperature we call zero Kelvin. And the Big Bang made a huge temperature 13.8 billion years ago. And all of that stuff from that Big Bang explosion has been cooling off for 13.8 billion years and is now down to the temperature of 2.73 degrees Kelvin, 2.73 Kelvin. So setting where is absolute zero is really an extending the straight line graph as to where do the molecules stop moving. That's my guess as to what's going on here, John. I mean, Joe. W2LYY, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Okay, sounds like what you're saying, if I derived this correctly, is a theoretical estimation of what zero temperature or 0 degrees or no movement of matter, where everything just stopped moving. So they've only proved this really theoretically, but it's never been actually measured. Am I correct in that, or that's not correct?
You're very close, Joe. And when I talk about movement of molecules, I'm talking about translational movement. I am not saying that the electrons going around that nucleus stop moving. If the electrons stop moving on an oxygen molecule, you haven't got oxygen anymore. So the electrons moving around the nucleus, they're still moving. That's not what we're measuring. We're measuring trends. The whole darn molecule has a mass center, and we're keeping track of the mass center speed of that air molecule. Now, with better and better refinement of refrigeration systems and more elaborate procedures, they've gone down to, at one time they got down to a Kelvin, a tenth of a Kelvin, a hundredth of a Kelvin, millikelvin. They're down to microkelvin now. In other words, with real elaborate cooling techniques, and some of the elaborate cooling techniques are done with a laser. You take a small number of molecules you've captured into this trap, and you see them moving a little bit to the left or to the right, and you turn on the laser in the right direction to stop that motion. So using lasers aimed at the molecules, you're able to stop their motion. But by doing techniques like this, we've gotten down to microkelvin. The fact that you've gotten down to microkelvin, and you can see the straight line projection of the temperature that you think you're measuring, the amount of motion that you think you're seeing, it all comes together. The fact that with great difficulty you get down to microkelvin tells me that where you think absolute zero is, I'm pretty sure you're within a microkelvin of the right number. Over to you, Joe, to B2RYY, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Now, have they measured temperatures off of these spacecraft that are way, way, way out there, like 13 billion miles or so? And you're so far away from the sun, what is the heat energy, what is the temperature energy out there? It's got to be very, very close to this magic zero number, right?
That's one way of looking at it. What you're really asking is, does Voyager have thermometers on board? Absolutely. The best way to measure temperature of space is to do the Penzias-Wilson experiment. Penzias and Wilson, using this great big Hoghorn antenna that's now a national cherished item in New Jersey, and there's a great big plaque alongside of it. They saw this excess hiss, and they calculated that it was 2.73 degrees. Well, many radio telescopes in space have aimed a horn at some dark corner of space and really measured an amount of radio noise that equals 2.73 degrees Kelvin. So there's a lot of confirmation that that is the residual temperature of the Big Bang, and every direction you aim that's not directly at some star or at the center of some galaxy, you'll measure that temperature. And are you familiar with the so-called Alper's paradox? If I remember correctly, Alper's paradox is that, hey, if space goes on to infinity in every single direction, that means if you look long enough in that direction, you're eventually going to be seeing a star. So, to some degree, and the ultra-deep field done by Hubble Space Telescope came close to making that kind of a measurement. Let me drop one. So, if every direction you look, you're eventually looking at a star. Therefore, there's a star in every direction. Therefore, the whole sky should be white. And the whole sky is black. How come? That's Alper's paradox. Well, by way of the ultra-deep field, where you see 10,000 galaxies in that photograph, I've got a copy of it, that have never been seen before. And you're about to ask, how many degrees of space is in that photograph? If you took a 1 millimeter square piece of paper, you know what 1 millimeter is, a very small piece of paper, and you held it away from your eye 1 meter away, that piece of paper left and right, up and down, is 3 seconds of arc. 1/10 of the diameter of the moon in azimuth, 1/10 of the diameter of the moon in elevation, 1% of the moon in area. That's how much angular extent, after all the magnification of Hubble, is in that photograph. You'd have to take that photograph some number of billions of times to cover the whole sky. And by the way, each one of those photographs is 10 days of integrating, 1 million seconds of integrating to get that photograph, to get the really deep, dim stars that are in there. So, as you can see, if you've got enough gain in the camera, enough light amplification, let me drop this. Depending on your point of reference, the sky is white. If I took that Hubble deep field picture, the ultra deep field picture, and multiply it by 10 or 100 times in sensitivity or seconds of integration, if I did it 10 or 100 times more, we know darn well a hell of a lot of those very dim things didn't come above threshold of that photograph, and a hell of a lot more things would. So, and you can now buy a camera which has an ASA rating of something like 240,000. You can almost take a picture with that camera with the lens cap on. So you use a high enough sensitivity camera and a long enough integration period, what you think is a black sky is really white. Ain't that a crazy one? The K2RYY, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
I never heard of a camera having that kind of sensitivity where it could actually see or detect light through a black lens cap. That's pretty good.
I didn't say anybody has taken a picture through the lens cap, but when you've got an ASA rating on the camera, something like 240,000, that's very close to taking a picture through the lens cap. Because the word dark is a very relative word. Some amount of light is coming through that lens cap. And so, we're inventing more and more sensitive cameras that require less and less time. All of the astrophotography that the backyard astronomers used to use needed a tracking motor. You had to move the camera as the sky is rotating because the Earth is rotating. You're taking a picture for 3 minutes, 10 minutes, or whatever. With these cameras now that have such extremely high sensitivity, you don't need a tracking motor anymore. You just aim the camera on the tripod any direction you care about. You take a picture of 1/100 of a second, and there's the picture of the sky, because the camera is so sensitive that you used to have to take a 10-minute picture. Now you do it in 1/100 of a second. Ain't that crazy, Joe? K2RIW.
It's fascinating when you think about all this stuff, and you start putting pieces of this stuff together. So, okay, yeah, well, I guess you think of the, there is no up and down in space. I mean, there's stuff in any direction you could possibly look at, stars and the like. So, where's your way you're going to go? But it's funny, it's funny when you think about it, how the planets around the sun are, I guess, close elliptical alignment of each other, where you're on a certain plane, even looking out as far as Pluto. I mean, you don't have Pluto, like, overhead, where, you know, going to different north, at least as far as I understand. Maybe I'm wrong on that.
You're absolutely right, Joe. All the planets around this solar system are all moving counterclockwise top view. Their plane of orbit is all within a couple of degrees of each other. They're all in the same plane. That strongly suggests two or three things. Number one, the cloud of materials that was left out when our sun coalesced from this great big cloud of spinning material, a hell of a lot of the material fell into the thing that you and I call the sun, and a lot of stuff was left over circulating around the sun. That stuff circulating around the sun was essentially all circling in one direction. There's a whole lot of reasons why things tend to form into a plane. Of all the stuff that got scattered by some means that became the rings of Saturn, when you wait long enough, all those stuff in the rings of Saturn eventually settle into one plane. Even if something disturbs an object and it's moving up and down, it eventually settles down to be in that plane. There's something about the way the forces balance each other. So all of those planets on this solar system are in the same plane, moving in the same direction, and each of those orbits are fairly close to circular. Every orbit is an ellipse, but the amount of ellipticity is very small. Each one of those is very close to a darn circular orbit, all in the same plane. You're right on that one. And even the moon going around the Earth is only a few degrees tilted compared to our equator. Over you, Joe, KQLIW.
Intelligent question.
So thinking about what you just said with space being this 2.73 Kelvin, minus, you know, around that figure, as far as they've been able to tell, these planets that are very far away from us, Uranus, Neptune, Pluto, something that's really far out there.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Can it really be from the sun? Because the sun is like, you know, billions of miles away.
A hell of a lot of the heat of our planet is because of the radioactivity that's taking place in the center of our planet. On top of that, all the material that fell into what you and I call Earth fell at some particular velocity. In the very beginning, the heat that was created by all the stuff crashing into this mass center called Earth created a hell of a lot of heat. And the planet has been very slowly cooling off. And have we reached thermal equilibrium? As far as the original heat, I think so. But when it comes to the radioactivity in the center of our planet, a hell of a lot of heat is coming there. The core temperature of Earth is some huge number. If somebody told me it's 5,000 degrees Kelvin, I'd believe it. It's some really big number, the core of Earth. So each one of the planets has a similar method of where the original heat came from and how they're maintaining that heat now. Now, the average temperature of Pluto, guarantee, is a small fraction of the average temperature of the Earth. It's a very small object, very far away, getting very little solar energy, and its original amount of thermal inertia, the original amount of specific heat, the amount of mass there. Pluto is smaller than our moon, if I remember correctly. When I pass it over to Paul, he's going to correct me on that. But first, let's pick up Wes. N2XJN, KQIW. Go ahead, Wes.
From different fields, I sent you a set of the pictures asking what is that. Can you figure out? Because I believe I already figured out. I got it also for 2 hours today.
Okay, I'll take a look at that in a minute. Paul, am I correct in that Pluto is smaller than our moon? I think it is. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I believe so. And I... Ganymede is it's bigger. So, yeah, Pluto's pretty small, but I'm going to guess 1,600 miles? I forgot now. I'll have to look that up. You can find that real quick. Back to you.
So, Have you run out of questions along these lines that you're up to B2RYY? Good questions, K2RIW.
No, I'm pretty much done for this evening. It's funny how one question can sort of lead to another, just as a matter of curiosity. I guess one final one. What does a Kelvin equate to in Fahrenheit? I think our temperature now is 273 Kelvin, so I'd have to figure it out myself. Absolute zero is considered what? Minus 450 Fahrenheit, approximately?
Yes, I'm going to... zero Kelvin, zero centigrade is 273 Kelvin. So, minus 273 centigrade. Oh, wait a minute. My calculator's got a whole bunch of factors built in. So, in about 30 seconds, I'll tell you exactly how many degrees Fahrenheit, how many degrees centigrade. I know that it's going to be minus 273 centigrade is zero Kelvin. And now what is it in Fahrenheit? Using that 4/5, the 5/9 rule plus 32, you'd come up with it real fast. There's been a couple of NOVA programs on what happens when you get down to these super cold temperatures where you start getting superconductivity and all kinds of crazy effects. Liquid helium becomes a superfluid. No matter how small the screening is in the bottom of your container, you can have a holes in your screening that are a micrometer in diameter, and you cool liquid helium to the correct temperature, and it'll find a way to get through those holes. In fact, it also will crawl out of the sides of your container. So helium, liquid helium at super cold temperatures has got...
Repeater, time out.
At super cold temperatures, liquid helium has got some really strange characteristics. Most things contract when they get cold. Liquid helium below a certain temperature starts expanding. Unfortunately, that crazy characteristic, it's got some explosive capability if you're not careful with how you're using it. But you said Ganymede is already bigger than Pluto. Ganymede is the third... planet, and the third moon go around Jupiter. Jupiter, Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto, the four major Galileo moons. Those four major moons are the first things that Galileo saw in his telescope. He saw objects going around another thing that we now know as the planet Pluto, and he suddenly realized, wow, the sun ain't the center of our universe. The sun ain't the center of our... what we now know as solar system. That's what proved it to him. Any comments along all of this, Paul? WS2N, K2IW.
Yeah, but 2 Kelvin is the space vacuum.
And Galileo missed the other 60. There's over 60 moons now around Jupiter. Remember when you were young, you could try to remember, it was not too hard to remember a lot of the moons around the different planets. And you can't do it. There's over 60 moons around Jupiter alone.
AB2LR.
Okay, zero Kelvin is -459.67 Fahrenheit. -459.67 Fahrenheit there, Joe. AC2LR, K2RIW, go ahead, Kay.
I have a quick question for Paul. Colored clouds that they're releasing from the rocket tomorrow night, are they supposed to luminesce? When I was looking tonight at between 9:04 and 9:19, it was pretty dark out, and I don't get how they think we're going to see them if they're not pretty luminescent.
I didn't read that they're luminescent, but, nighttime here is 8:45, or a little bit later now, 8:50. So if it goes up at 9:04, 9:07, by the time it gets up to a couple hundred miles, I think it still should be light up there. So I'm guessing the light is going to be reflecting off the cloud. Okay, back to you.
know, nowadays we get sunset very close to 8:30 local time, daylight saving time. That sunset, the sun has to set another 6 degrees to be civil twilight, another 6 degrees to be nautical twilight, another 6 degrees to be astronomical twilight. So you got to go 18 more degrees. The Earth is rotating 15 degrees per hour, so you got to go more than another hour and a fraction after sunset before you get astronomical twilight. So there's still going to be some light up there as I see it, K. AC2LR, K2LIW.
I was down at the beach tonight between 9:04 and 9:19, and it was like dark enough to see second and third magnitude stars. So it's darker than dusk. Anyway, I guess we'll find out tomorrow. Hopefully it'll be clear and we'll find out, right?
Yeah, Paul, what's the prediction as to how visible these clouds that are going to be emitted, how visible are they going to be, and is it likely on Long Island, if we have clear enough sky, that we'll be able to see it? WS2N, K2IW.
Well, they said New York. They didn't say what part of New York. Naturally, we're in the southern end. So I'm hoping that if you look at the horizon, you should be able to see it. But we'll have to wait and find out. I think we'll be able to see it because when you have a launch of, let's say, an Antares launch, they go up about 15 degrees on our horizon, and, you know, they're going out over the ocean. So, I mean, they're only going up at that point maybe 60 or 80 miles when we lose sight of it. This thing's going up, they said, a couple of hundred miles. So we should be able to see the ionosphere from here. And I did the same thing, Kay. I went out around that time, but then I came back and looked on the computer, and I realized they scrubbed the mission because of a little too cloudy, and at the same time, somebody was out in a boat, rowing a boat, probably. I don't know. Somebody was out in a boat. They called the mission. That happens a lot. They check the range, and they find out there's some boat that didn't get the memo. Back to you, Derek.
Paul, this launch tomorrow, they're going to go up to a certain altitude and release gases or chemicals into the atmosphere, and we're going to see certain colors. What is the purpose? Why are they doing this, Paul? Go ahead.
The last I read on the internet, it was a NASA site, was they're going to watch where this cloud goes in the ionosphere. You know, it's going to move from one point to another. They want to see where it's going, how fast it's going, how fast it's dispersing, that type of thing. So that's what they're doing.
I'm wondering why they think they've got to do that, because we got various kinds of radars that can look volumetrically at sky and tell you how fast and in what direction the materials are moving in that area. So by way of radar, you can probe the atmosphere at almost every altitude and measure how fast the molecules in that volume are moving. Over to you, Paul. K2LIW.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess with depends on what you're looking at. This, you know, this cloud is a man-made cloud, and they want to see which way it's going to go. And visually looking at it, so the chemicals themselves change all of that. It's, you know, what they're made out of. One's going to give a bluish green. Another one's going to give a red. You know, are they going to move different directions? Is there some question about the mass? I don't know. I have no idea. Don't have enough information yet about the physics behind what they're trying to do here. And looking at the time, we don't have enough to figure it out. Back to you, Dick, WS2N.
Yeah, we're 15 seconds beyond the bewitching hour. What you guys have just heard was TechNet number 1,654. Space report number 254. That's it for tonight. 73, you all. Be kind to each other. Don't take this stuff too serious. This is a hobby. We're here to enjoy it and share the information with each other. Bye-bye, you all. See you next week. K2IW clear. And Paul's going to tie the ribbons on if he's got any further words. You got it, Paul. K2IW clear.
think you forgot to look at the pictures.
For a launch on the SpaceX website on Saturday, I think 2 o'clock in that area, and you should be able to see another geosynchronous launch from Launch Complex 39A, and usually about 7-8 minutes after the launch, you'll see the booster come back and, you know, they have great video now of landing on these autonomous vehicles. And the name of this one is, Of Course I Still Love You. That's the name of the vehicle. 73, guys, well, have a good night. WSLM will be clear.
You forgot to look at the pictures.
I'm downloading it right now. Lots of megabytes.
One question. What is it? I put it also for $2 today.
Megabytes. Took me a while to download that.
It shouldn't be that much. Just a few pictures. Low resolution.
Yeah, I'm seeing one face of a printed circuit board. And I almost recognize what the other face might look like. So because of what Roy sent us, we now know for sure it is a quadrature hybrid.
No, I'm talking about the second one. The first one was too easy. The second one, so you actually downloading all of the pictures. But I sent you the second set, and Dr. Roy's today is simply too fast. She is too fast. The other one is interesting because it doesn't look traditional. It's a piece of art. Of general radio.
Yeah, general radio, wire wound, multi tap potentiometer.
What is that for?
Some kind of a precision resistor setup of some kind.
Yeah, that's what I was able to figure out is exactly what Dr. Roy was able. It is either Kelvin bridge or an impedance bridge. The tolerance is 0.75%. 1% of all of those steady resistors, they're winded. But those are, there is a 1-1 in the middle that has a 3 dials on it. It has a 3 sections. Do you see that?
I sure do. 3 different pickoffs. 3 different pickoffs of that wire wound resistor.
And it's unbelievable. It's simply unbelievable. I never...
visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
All token effing.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
KD2NNZ, KD2NNZ, mobile and monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
KD2NNZ signing off.
WQVL repeater system.
Okay.